morning and welcome to A Novel Idea. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host. Tonight, we're exploring new methods of publication, the small press, and a new technique, new to us anyway, called print on demand, or POD. We'll be featuring three writers and their works. Stephanie Friel of Healdsburg, who's just been selected as the Literary Laureate of Healdsburg. And she is a writer of short stories, and her short story collection is called Feeding Strays. In fact, these are very short stories. They're called flash fiction, a new genre to us. The second author whom we'll be talking with is Chester Aaron. Now, Chester has been publishing for years. Many of us are familiar with his famous book about garlic, but he's just been awarded the 2009 Moonbeam Award for his historical fiction aimed at young adults. The book is called Gideon, just republished by Zumaya Press. Our third writer is Beth Carpell, who's just published her first novel called Assembling Georgia. So we're presenting new publishing techniques in three different genres, in young adult fiction, in short stories, and in the novel. I don't know if you've noticed, but Healdsburg is a real literary hub here in Sonoma County. And at a specially staged Third Sunday Salon event in October, Stephanie Friel of Healdsburg was selected to be Healdsburg's next and sixth literary laureate. Her two-year term will begin on January 1st. Stephanie Friel is the 2008 Kathy Fish Fellowship Writer in Residence for Smokelong Quarterly. She has an MFA for the Northwest Institute of Literary Arts, Whidbey Writers Workshop. Recent work has appeared or is forthcoming in Glimmer Train, American Literary Review, Talking River, Literary Mama, among others. Stephanie Friel's book, Feeding Strays, just published by Lost Horse Press, is a collection of 50 short stories. Let's hear Stephanie read one of her stories from Feeding Strays.
This is a story called Tinfoilers. It is late afternoon, and Jordan is 12, when the three white unmarked pickups drive up in the dust. Cornbread, the dog, barks and growls. Jordan calls the dog off and ties him to the trailer hitch. Men in sunglasses, flashing papers and envelopes, argue with Jordan's father. When they leave, Jordan's father goes into their trailer and comes out with a glass. If you've ever had a bad day, this is the taste you'll want to make it better. Jordan knows to close his eyes and let his dad hold the glass. They've been doing this for years. He isn't sure what taste to expect. Perhaps lemonade, but the flavor is cold and tremendous. Root beer, the good stuff. They spend their last night sharing, talking around the burn barrel with their neighbor, Winnie Heald, who is also forced to move. Jordan and his dad plan to buy the property back when they make it big. Winnie says to hell with it. He's going to Oregon to work on a cousin's crab boat. The New Mexico sky is dark and wide and all Jordan's. Cornbread sleeps on a shoe. When he is 28, Jordan's girlfriend Pammy says that people living in trailers listen to Art Bell and wear foil under their hats to ward off governmental airwave interference. Tinfoil alert! She waves to a white t-shirted man hoisting a tire toward a three-legged pickup. If he wasn't wearing that hat, the gov would subliminally force him to donate to the Republican Party. The man drops the tire. It bounces and rolls next to the road. Pammy watches him in the rearview mirror as they drive past. Betcha he got that tire off Buck's Ford L250. Paid him a sixer. Enough. Jordan gets tired of her sometimes. What? Sanford and Son doesn't want his people picked on? Hey, some people live in houses, some don't. Some underground, too. That way the gamma rays can't reach them. He turns up the radio. They're going to a wedding. People he's never met, and she barely knows. He wants his faded Bermuda shorts and his lawn chair. At a stop sign, Jordan elbows Pammy away from the mirror to show her a fading sign in front of a closed gas station. Freshest chew in town. Pammy grabs his hand and presses it to her cheek. You do me right, I'll get you that sign. At the reception, he tries to feed her a chocolate-dipped strawberry. She plucks it from his hand and shoves it into her mouth. When he is 33, at the early birth of their first child, Jordan calls his father from the hospital. It's a boy, 10 of everything. On my way, you better let that woman of yours get some rest. Melanie, his exhausted wife, sleeps, yet her legs still quiver. Jordan's dad shows up with the littlest pair of fur boots and a large bag of fish and chips. He stinks up the hospital room, and Melanie wakes, hungry. Jordan's dad kisses the nose of the yet unnamed infant, places him in his son's lap, and tells Melanie to close her eyes and open her mouth. Jordan holds the soft baby next to his cheek, listening to the smallest, eh, ah, while his father, in a soiled shirt and muddy shoes, feeds fried fish to the mother of his child. I can feed myself, she giggles, but Jordan's father tells her to keep her eyes closed and taste every bite. Jordan tries hard not to fall asleep, thinking of when he was young, how he would sit under the trailer awning in the morning sometimes, mouth open and eyes closed, waiting for his father's surprise, waffles or French toast. He could usually tell by the smell.
The stories in Feeding Strays are a type of writing called flash fiction, a very, very short form. Here, Stephanie tells us about flash fiction and her own writing.
Well, it's a short story collection. There are already over 50 short stories, and it just came out with a very small press, Lost Horse Press in Northern Idaho. And I'm running around doing a lot of readings and meet and greets and that sort of thing to publicize my book, which is what authors need to do these days. Most of Feeding Strays is flash fiction. What I consider flash fiction is pretty much the definition that Smokeland Quarterly has, which is fiction less than 1,000 words. Some people say flash fiction is less than 500 or maybe 1,200, but just to make it simple, around less than 1,000 words. I have a 2-year-old, so most of my fiction these days is flash fiction, just because of that. There are a couple of stories in Feeding Strays that are a little bit longer. I think the longest one is about 4,000 words, but primarily they're very short. A lot of it, I think, had to do with having a child. You know, I was 40 and was surprised. We were surprised, pleasantly surprised, with having a baby, and I could only write when I could write, which was in short bits. I just became a fan of it and read more and more of it. I had a professor at the Northwest Institute of Literary Arts, Woodby Writers Workshop, and his name is Bruce Hondlin Rogers, and he really turned me on to more and more flash fiction. And before then, aside from my own short writing, I hadn't known it had a title, and then I just read more of it and fell in love with it. Perhaps when my son's older, I'll write longer fiction again, but might be a while. Well, I think a short story, you have more time to get into some backstory and, you know, tell why the character is, you know, at the hospital and why the two are fighting. And in flash fiction, you may not even need to know that they're fighting, but you know that they're tense or why they're fighting. You have a lot more generosity affordable to you for a short story than for flash fiction. I think you also make an assumption with flash fiction and prose poem that the reader is intelligent enough to figure out what's going on without bringing forth all that background. I love novels, and I love short stories, and I also love flash fiction. So you might read a piece of flash fiction and just bemoan yourself because you don't have the novel to get in and explore those characters. And it's too late. Story's over. For the book, I found that for a first-time author for a short story collection, it was almost impossible to get an agent or approach a large press. So I was really pleased to get a small press to do a short story collection. And apparently that's the way to go, is the small press or perhaps a contest, that kind of thing. The online, just in the short time that I've been taking writing quite seriously, which has been 5 or 6 years, at the beginning of that, no one that I knew of gave online work a thought at all. It wasn't legitimate or something, or anybody could be online. Now I think it's much more well-respected literary magazines that are online.
Stephanie is not only a writer, a mother, and the next literary laureate of Healdsburg, Stephanie is an editor. And she tells us about some of her editorial work, especially with the online publication Smokelong Quarterly, which is dedicated to bringing the best flash fiction to the web. The term Smokelong comes from the Chinese, who noticed that reading a piece of flash takes about the same length of time as smoking a cigarette.
I actually have three editorial projects that I'm involved in. One, I'm the fiction editor for the Los Angeles Review, which is a literary magazine it's a print magazine that should be out next week or next issue, and actually none of the staff live in L.A. We all live in various places north, and it's a subsidiary of Red Hen Press, which is a small press, also like Lost Horse Press, but mostly devoted to poetry. So that issue will be coming out with a lot of wonderful authors like Lydia Davis and Steve Almond, etc. I'm also an editor with Smoke Long Quarterly, which is a online flash fiction magazine 4 times a year. And I'm part of that staff. And I'm also an editor for a anthology that is complete and with an agent, and we're seeking publication, and it's called Dogs Wet and Dry, a collection of canine flash fiction. Smoke Long is interesting. There's a whole team of us that read, and just the submission process itself is interesting. I think we only take about 2% of the submissions. We get hundreds of submissions, and they come online, and we read them blind. We have no idea, you know, who's sending us a story. We each have a day of the week where we read what we call the slush pile. And then if we find something we like, we bring it to the team and we all hash it out. Do we like this? Do we not? What do we like about it? It's either somebody either absolutely raves about it and loves it so much, or the team agrees. And then we grab it and we bring the issue out 4 times a year. And it's usually, I don't know, maybe 15 or 20 short pieces. The authors can partner with an artist if they want for the site, for their work. And we also do what a lot of sites don't do, is that each author is interviewed. And so if you go to the bottom of their story, you can click on their 4 or 5 question interview, which I think is pretty interesting because then you get to know a little bit about the author. The title is from a Chinese term meaning that the stories are a smoke long.
Stephanie follows some local greats. Previous Healdsburg laureates were Doug Stout, co-founder of the Farmers Market, and later the Literary Produce Table there that featured the works of local authors and mentor to many of them. Armando Garcia Davila, known as the Blue Collar Poet, or the Gourmet Poet, who writes bilingually and brought the Poetry Slam movement to Sonoma County. Penelope LaMontagne, who for years began the KRCB public radio programming day with her morning haiku, was a poet in the schools and popular writing workshop leader. Chip Wendt, who began the Third Sunday Salon in 2000 and, as Running Wolf publisher, published the first poetry collections of many area writers, and the current laureate, Vilma Ginsberg, who now hosts the Third Sunday Salon and has been an active board member of the Healdsburg Literary Guild. And now, Stephanie Friel.
First there was the search committee, and there was this group of thugs, these poets that got together and forced me to fill out the forms to apply for it. I think they did that to several people. And the secret committee weaned us down to two, Maria Bien and I. We were invited to a read-off, and they transformed the upstairs of the Frank Howard Allen Realty, which is usually kind of like a messy warehouse, into a nightclub-type scene. It was beautiful with lights and candles and wine and food. There was probably 50 people there. It was fantastic. And all the previous laureates read, with the exception of Doug Stout, who passed away, and Chip Wendt, who wasn't there, but some people read for him. And then Maria and I each had about 18 to 20 minutes to read, and then there was the secret voting after that. It was like being in another world. It was very fun, and the people were terrific. I got a memo that said I don't need to play any role whatsoever, that I can just be this. But I would like to, you know, if I have any clout and power and persuasion, we have this in Healdsburg, this giant square that they have a lot of events in, and I would love to have a literary event. I was specifically thinking of one called Full Moon Fiction, where, if possible, if I could get some of these Californians that don't like the cold to show up at night and, you know, gather around the gazebo and listen to a reading, I think that would be really neat. That also, and go to some schools and, you know, maybe read in some English classes of teenagers and entice them to come to some of the open mics and the literary events, because right now in Healdsburg there really isn't any youth present at any of the events, and there should be. There's the Healdsburg Lit Cafe, which is the second Tuesday, I believe, of every month, and then there's the salon, the Third Sunday Salon, which is hosted by the Literary Guild, and then there's a number of, like, I'm in a group called the Scrambled Eggs, and I think there's about 10 of us, and there's a lot of little small groups, and it seems like every time you turn around, there's a reading somewhere, so yeah, it's a pretty good literary community.
And that coming from the new Literary Laureate of Healdsburg, Stephanie Friel. Lost Horse Press has just published her new book of flash fiction, Feeding Strays. You can check out Smokelong Quarterly online at www.smokelong.com. You can visit her at www.stephaniefriel.com, and you can hear Stephanie in person on November 15th at Coffee Cats in Sebastopol, where she'll be the featured reader. Thank you, Stephanie Friel. Chester Aaron is the prolific author of novels, stories, and memoirs. He saw combat in World War II and was with the troops that liberated Dachau. He retired as a full professor from St. Mary's College in 1997. He has a worldwide reputation for the 90 varieties of exotic garlic he grows on his farm in Sonoma County. In addition, Chester was just awarded a 2009 Moonbeam Award for his historical fiction aimed at young adults. Gideon, just republished by Zumaya Press. Chester talks about that experience.
Gideon was published originally in 1982 by Lippincott, and it was a young adult novel, and it was the fifth novel I published, but the fourth young adult novel. It was the only novel that I have written, or only story that I have written, about my military experiences or the Holocaust. I was with the troops that liberated Dachau in 1945. The book was provoked by a trip that I took to Israel, where I met several survivors who had been children in the camps. And when I came back to the U.S., I started writing the book. And at that time, I had an agent and I had a publisher. One of the editors in New York suggested that I do something about the Holocaust for young adults. And I had resisted doing it for some time, partly because I didn't like the memories. The book was published and received quite a bit of attention, and as with all books, it faded, and I forgot about it. That was in the 80s. 3 months ago, it was republished in paperback by a small independent publisher in Texas called Zumaya Publishing. Elizabeth Burton started this little independent publishing house, and I didn't expect too much to happen with it because with small independent publishers who publish what are called e-books or POD books, POD meaning print on demand. But then about a month ago, I received an email from her. It reads, Chester Celebration. Gideon, written by Chester Aaron, with cover and illustrations by Chris Cartwright and published by Zumaya Thresholds, is a semifinalist in the 2009 Moonbeam Awards in the Young Adult Historical Cultural category. Presented by Jenkins Group and Independent Publishers Online, the Moonbeam Children's Book Awards are designed to bring increased recognition to exemplary children's books and their creators, and to support childhood literacy and lifelong reading. And then about 2 weeks ago, I received notice that Gideon had won the silver medal. And not only that, when I started working with Gideon for Zumaya, I became involved again in writing about the Holocaust. And now that's almost all I'm writing.
His direct experience of Dachau is powerful, and Chester Aaron reflects candidly on its continuing effects.
I'm not sure how to talk about it, but an experience like the Holocaust has so many variations of responses and memories and effects that I feel I almost have to apologize because I was not a prisoner. I was a two-day visitor to the camp. And as horrible as that was, I can only imagine what it was like for those who were there. And so I feel a little bit like an intruder. The various soldiers who arrived have been referred to by both Germans and the prisoners as the liberators. And so that's the term which usually applies. And if you were to Google my unit, you would see the term liberators. The liberation of the camp always made me also a little uneasy, because liberating was not, we didn't free the camp. We freed the prisoners. And there's a difference. Liberating the camp suggests exposing it, opening it to exposure, and liberating the prisoners suggests permitting them to live on. And it was an experience that is very, very hard to put on paper. And yet that's what I feel I have to try. And not only the liberation, but the after effects of the liberation. And again, here I am with a two-day experience at the camp, having after effects, and I am almost embarrassed to think about how that relates or compares to the after effects of a year or two or three imprisonment in such a camp. And it's a little bit of a cheat, I feel.
Chester talks more about what inspired his writing of the book Gideon. Chester Aaron's books were first published over 30 years ago, and he has more than 20 titles. Even an author of his depth experiences difficulty in today's publishing culture. Chester, like many authors and those we're featuring today, have found new life with the small press and print-on-demand publications.
Oh, publishing has so changed. I have published 22 books now. And publishing 20, 25, 30 years ago was so different in so many ways from publishing today. In the 60s, 70s, 80s, to publish a novel was so much easier than it is to publish it today, whether you were young or old. Publishing has changed so drastically, especially with the arrival of the internet and what that has done to publishing. It's been so difficult, especially for older writers. For instance, about 10 years, almost exactly 10 years ago, when I was beginning to write a lot after having a brief, oh, 5, 6, 7, 8 years of very little publication or writing, I thought, well, I would get an agent again. And when I was writing and publishing in the 60s and 70s, I had all top agents, New York, top publishers, New York. So I typed out my vita, 3 pages long, of the honors and awards and translations, and sent copies to 30 different agents around the country, New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco. I had one response to my 30 letters, and it was a letter from an agent in New York. It was my letter returned to me, over which she had scribbled thanks, but no thanks. That was the only response I received. And so I called her in New York, and she said, oh, yes, Mr. Aaron. Let's face it, Mr. Aaron, how old are you? And at that time, 10 years ago, I was 76, and I said, 76. And she said, why should I waste my time and money on you? The publishers now, I want someone who is going to have at least 5, 6, 7 more books available for them before they publish the one you send them. And at 86, it's not likely that I'm going to be having 5, 6, 7, 8 more books, although since I last talked to her, I have had 5 books published. Now, Zumaya, which was founded by Elizabeth Burton, and I got in touch with her, and we made signed an agreement. And since then, I have had much, much contact with her. I've never met her personally. She says that she receives about 1,000 manuscripts a year from writers who want to be published. She publishes about 20 books. She shoulders all the debts. She edits She has her own designer. She does her own promotion. And she keeps her own records. We signed the same commercial contract that I signed with all publishers. But Elizabeth Burton is working 10, 12 hours a day, 6, 7 days a week because she loves doing what she loves. There are very few such publishers, and I am so fortunate to have found her. There are other independent publishers who are doing jobs just as important, and they publish these books, generally paperback, but almost all of them are what are called POD books, print on demand. And at first, about 10 years ago, when this became a term and a practice, printing on demand, the New York publishers and critics scorned such books because they were paperback. Bookstores now do not shelf POD books because they cannot return unused copies. But if they do not shelf a book, it is unlikely that a magazine or newspaper will review the book. So many POD books, which are increasing all over the country, they are not mentioned in reviews. And it is only on programs such as this on NPR where this kind of information is gotten out about such titles as Gideon.
Chester's books are available online from the publisher at an easy address to remember, novelideaszumaya.com, or you can request it from your local bookseller. Chester has a pretty nice website. That's chesteraaron.com. Zumaya also has Chester's latest book available, Murder by Metaphor. We're going to take a short break. You're listening to A Novel Idea. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host. We've been listening to the work of Stephanie Friel and Chester Aaron. And in the second half of the show, you'll hear my interview with Beth Karpel.
It's 4 in the morning, the end of December. I'm writing you now just to see if you're better. New York is cold, but I like where I'm living. There's music on Clinton Street all through the evening. I hear that you're building your little house deep in the desert. You're living for nothing now. I hope you're keeping some kind of record. Yes, and Jane came by with a lock of your hair. She said that you gave it to her that night that you planned to go clear. Did you ever go clear? Oh, the last time we saw you, you looked so much older. Your famous blue raincoat was torn at the shoulder. You'd been to the station to meet every train. Then you came home without Lily Marlene. And you treated my woman to a flake of your life. When she came back, she was nobody's wife. Well, I see you there with a rose in your teeth. One more thin gypsy thief. Well, I see Jane's away. She sends her regard.
And now we're back. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host for A Novel Idea. You're listening to our program about authors who have chosen what we think of as alternative methods of publication, the small press and print on demand. These may be the wave of the future. Let's listen to my interview with Beth Karpel, the author of the novel Assembling Georgia.
The package and the knife were where she'd left them on the table. She sat down, turned the box over, and pulled it toward her. Then she stopped and looked again. The box was not from her mother. Georgia's address was not scrawled in her mother's loopy script, but printed in a neat, firm hand. There was no flowery return address sticker from Wisconsin. There was no return address at all. Georgia couldn't think who would be sending her anything. If she'd been an airline executive or politician, and not just a tired chicken factory worker distracted by her ridiculous mugging, she might have paused. She might have appreciated how one small box could change the course of a life, and hesitated. But as apprehensive as she was of the world outside, the idea of hazard within her own walls didn't occur to her. She just gave a short grunt of disappointment as the idea of chocolate chip cookies slipped away. Then she opened the box. In a padding of styrofoam peanuts lay four objects wrapped with clean buff newspaper and clear tape. One was marked with a large dot. Georgia lifted it out and unwrapped it. It was a light, smooth metal cylinder, hollowed out from an irregular bottom, circled with grooved rings around the top. Small holes were bored through the sides. It gleamed with the barest sheen of oil. There were two tags attached. The smaller one said, Piston 1A. The other was a card, tied on with gold string like at Christmas time. Dear Georgia, it read, please hold on to this. Regards. Regards? Who on earth is sending me regards? Questions began combusting in George's brain. Who has my address? Why would anyone send me pistons, of all things? Is someone trying to tell me my car's falling apart like I don't already know? Is this some kind of mistaken identity? Why me? The metal was cool and hard, a feeling of precision and the potential for what? Several things moved within Georgia at once. Bewilderment, suspicion, and something so rusty with disuse, it almost didn't get started at all. Interest.
You've been listening to Beth Karpel reading from her new novel, Assembling Georgia. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host for A Novel Idea. Beth is my guest here in the studio to talk about Assembling Georgia, one of the most interesting novels I've read in quite a while. Beth, it's so good to have you here to talk about your book.
Thank you so much, Rosemary. It's great to be here.
Good. And your home is in Nevada.
Right. Eastern Nevada.
Uh-huh. And I was reading some of the biographical material you sent, which is quite impressive, that in Nevada you built your own house, raised two sons, written a play, and that this is your first novel. That's just for starters. That's pretty impressive.
Well, thank you. And what have you done lately?
Exactly. And it was such a pleasure to hear you introduce your character, Georgia Dunn, who receives in the very beginning of the book this mysterious package, followed by a whole series of packages. The cover of your novel, the photographs you took yourself, right?
I did.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Great photographs. Give us a little clue as to what all these mechanical parts might be, because we see on the cover a motorcycle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Georgia doesn't figure it out for a little while.
Right.
But when she does, it just turns her life upside down.
Oh, yes.
The parts come from nowhere, really. Mm-hmm. She has no clue and doesn't for quite a while, although I have to tell you the reader finds out long before Georgia does what's going on with all of that.
And she throws them away.
She almost does.
Almost. Just puts them in the dumpster.
That's right. That's right. She almost loses a chance that would probably never come again. I think all of us think of that. We think, what has happened in our life that is the opportunity that we can sort of go with? And have we thrown it away already? And will another one come around again? But yes, Georgia, through just disbelief and fear, tosses it out.
She's in a bad spot when we first meet her, but she's so, I was going to say plucky. That's such a cliche, but she is. She's down but not out.
Yeah. She is. I don't think she would think of herself as in that way at all.
No.
In fact, I think she thinks of herself as very ordinary. She's at a dead end, but mm-hmm. she has pretty much resigned herself to the fact that that's how her life is going to be. And that's as good as it's going to get.
Mm-hmm. Her no-good boyfriend has left her. She's working in a chicken factory in right. Minneapolis. And her life is a bit bleak, but mm-hmm. it's about to get better.
The mysterious box, right? Mm-hmm. It does turn her life around. I mean, it's odd to have a catalyst that is so out of the blue.
Yes. I want to tell you that I immediately was with your protagonist, Georgia.
Oh, good.
And you know, that's so important in a book. Mm-hmm. You want to grab the reader, and boy, you certainly grabbed me by the time.
Thank you very much. It means especially much because I had to work very hard at that. When I started the book, I didn't know the character very well. And I learned about her, and I think she got more, she got to be a richer character as the story went on. So I had to go back to the beginning and find a way to, you know, make that sense of who she was evident from the very beginning.
Mm-hmm. And then you had to build her backstory so that
right.
you could mm-hmm. gradually present that to the reader.
Right.
And
well, that presented itself to me. It was a very interesting process for me, mm-hmm. this writing business.
Yeah, tell me about your writing. Yes.
Yeah. I find that I am not very good at plotting. I have to just take a leap of faith.
Yes.
And let the characters do what they're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, it was an absolute miracle that this became a coherent story. Because I was just following the narrative as I was writing it. There were times the characters were doing things that shocked me. I didn't know what they were going to be doing until they did it, until the words were on the page. And so I had to try not to direct them and just let them do what they were going to do and take that leap and just believe that things were going to work out and become a story that had a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Yes.
It was very surprising to me that that happened.
It must be so much fun to write fiction.
Oh, it is.
You never know what your characters are going to come up with.
That's right.
That's right. But in addition to building your house and mm-hmm. raising your sons and mm-hmm. all of this, have you always written?
No, I haven't. When I was very young, it was something that I liked to do and had an idea that I would like to do in the future.
Uh-huh.
And then I really didn't do it much at all. I've done quite a few of other creative endeavors. Uh-huh. I've done a lot of oil painting for a number of years. And then I've always done photography.
Uh-huh.
So I really applied myself creatively to those things. And it was a matter of determining that I couldn't put this aside any longer. This was something that I wanted to do. I wanted to write.
Uh-huh.
I had always wanted to write. So what was I waiting for?
Uh-huh. But you have an eye for detail to pick out exactly the detail that will engage the reader. And I kept noticing that there was one point at which she's traveling somewhere and she pulls off the road into a field. And you said it was a flax field.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, that makes all the difference. I have no idea what flax looks like when it's growing, but it gave me a specific clue. And so then I kept noticing the skill with which you brought these things in. And I thought, well, now when I meet Beth, I want to find out where she learned to write. Was it just by doing it?
You know what? I've read so much, and I pay attention.
Yes.
I'm not a particularly fast reader,
mm-hmm.
and I don't just read to get the storyline.
Yes.
I really enjoy reading. I love the way words are strung together.
Yes.
Also, I have to give credit. When I did start writing and hadn't done it for so long, I thought, I need some help here. Mm-hmm. So I went to the library. Where else? And I got some tapes out by Natalie Goldberg.
Oh, yes. Right.
It was so helpful.
Yes.
And that's one of the things she talks about.
Yes.
that it is those details yes. that engage the mind, that, that set a scene.
Mm-hmm.
I have to also give credit where credit is due. A good friend of mine towards the end of the book read it for me and went through the book and made a lot of marks on the edges mm-hmm. of the manuscript. Mm-hmm. You know, you can do better.
Yes.
You can, we need to see and feel and taste.
Yes, yes, yes.
So
yes.
she helped me with that too.
Uh-huh. So you have a good ear and a good eye, and you work hard. And you put it together.
Well, thank you. And it did take a lot of time to do it. The first draft I did in about 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that I did, I went to the library and got a book by Stephen King called
yes.
On Writing.
Isn't that an excellent book?
It is an excellent book. I thought
excellent.
If anybody knows how to write
that's
and
right.
to string those sentences together,
yes.
boy, that's who it is.
And it's so practical.
It's very
practical.
I mean,
he tells you how to write a page of a prose.
Right.
Yes.
He tells you how he does it.
Yes.
He's a little nuts as far
yes,
as I'm concerned
right.
because he writes 10 pages a day every day of the year. And I thought,
yes.
I can't do that. But I bet I could write 5 pages a day, 5 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
that's what I did.
Right. We both recommend that book to mm-hmm. all of you writers out there, Stephen King, On Writing. It's a
that's
great
right.
place to start.
It is.
Yeah.
Another way that I got myself into it was I went to the local college. I live in a small town in Nevada. I went up to the local college and looked for a creative writing class. The closest thing they had to a creative writing class was a remedial writing class. and I took it, and it was wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
We got to write descriptive essays and comparative essays and, you know, all sorts of different styles and genres of writing. And it was wonderful, and it got me really into the habit. I learned I can just sit down and
yes.
write for a period of time. It was just excellent. I
mm-hmm.
loved it.
Yeah.
And then I took a playwriting class at the
yes.
same college the next semester, wrote a play,
uh-huh.
and then got just where I was sitting down and writing short stories until finally I started writing a short story that it was very clear to me.
Mm-hmm.
Within a few pages that mm-hmm. this one was not going to resolve as a short story.
Mm-hmm.
This
and keep
one
going,
was,
right?
Yeah, yeah. This was the one that was going to mm-hmm. be the novel that I had been wanting to write.
Yeah. Did the motorcycle put itself into the story early on? Or where did that motorcycle come
I
from?
I know. Isn't that odd? Well, I've told people this. I really feel as though when you're writing, if you are doing it very honestly and not trying to push it. It's very much like dreaming, where you turn a certain part of your brain off, and all of these images from things you've done, from the past, from people you know, and from who knows where else, start rising to the surface.
Mm-hmm.
And this happened. That's part of what happened to me, although the thing that rose to the surface with the motorcycle was a lot more recent. I happened to have just bought my son a little motorcycle. So that was on the top of my brain, I guess.
Yeah. And you thought, I can use this.
Well, no, I didn't think that at all.
Oh,
it
not
just,
at all.
Again, it was a matter of, Natalie Goldberg talks about that.
I
you have
see.
To turn off that part of your brain
yes.
and just let things come. And
yes.
it just surfaced as part of this dynamic that was happening to Georgia,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and part of what was going to get her, excuse the pun, on the road.
On the road.
Yeah.
Yes. You're listening to A Novel Idea. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host. My guest, Beth Karpel, and I are discussing reading and writing and her new novel, which is called Assembling Georgia and has in it a motorcycle. When you said that you thought you weren't very good at plotting, I keep thinking about the plot of this novel. We have Georgia Dunn, who is beginning to receive the mysterious motorcycle parts, and her basset hound Albert, who is definitely a character in the story.
Oh, if you get a kick out of dogs, you need to meet Albert.
Yes, even if you don't, you need to meet Albert. He's wonderful, and her friend Corinne, and So we learn quite a bit about Georgia as the parts continue to come. And then another character is introduced a good way into the story. His name is Frank Morrow. And we know that there is a connection between the two of them. But for many, many pages, we have no idea how the author is going to connect Frank Morrow and Georgia Dunn. And to me, that was just fascinating, to take these two people and try to figure out, they must be related through the motorcycle, but how? And then you gradually reveal one clue after another. And at first you think, well, are they going to end up falling in love and marrying each other? You find out they were friends at one point
right,
in their life.
They were childhood friends.
Yes. And I, the reader, was just fascinated with this concept of the, and I saw them as two points far separated, with the author bringing these two points into closer and closer proximity, with the motorcycle being the what they had in common.
I wish I could take more credit for having figured all of that out. I really, so much of that happened very organically as mm-hmm. I was writing. Mm-hmm. I knew who Frank was.
Yes.
It's sort of like setting an intention and then just sort of letting things happen
yes.
until that manifests itself. And I became actually very fond of Frank.
Yes.
I'm sorry. I have to say I became very fond of, it's shameful to say this, very fond of all of my characters.
Oh, yes. Well, I think one does. Yes.
Yeah. There were so many times that I just didn't know, particularly with Frank, how things were going to turn out for him. I worried about him a lot.
Well, I also want to bring in her wonderful Uncle Emery, who is such a lovable character. He's shy. He has great skills in machinery and mm-hmm. helps her, of course, with the motorcycle. But he was very important in your story. What
he
a
was.
Lovely character.
Yes, that sort of elfin quality to him
yes.
Was something that I liked quite a bit.
Yes,
I also found that he tied in with a lot of my life as well. He didn't know his a lot of his birth family.
Yes,
he grew up a little bit separated from them, mm-hmm. or completely separated from most
yes.
of them, I should say.
Yeah,
and when he did find them, he was very shy about forming the connections. Having this thing happen to Georgia didn't just happen to Georgia. The stone dropping in the water, the rings went out, and it touched quite a few people, including Emery.
That's right.
I don't think that Georgia necessarily would have been able to have formed the bond she did with Emery without the catalyst of the motorcycle, not mm-hmm. just in terms of the situation mm-hmm. and going to him for help. But I think it opened something in her.
Yeah, they needed something to do together.
They needed something to yes. do together. But yes. I think for both of them, putting the motorcycle together opened up, I don't know, maybe a sense of confidence and a renewed understanding of what they were capable of, not just being able to put a motorcycle together, but to form other connections.
Mm-hmm. Through reading. He was a great reader.
He was a great reader.
And,
yeah.
and she was not. Yeah. And she was not. So he took her to the library.
That's right.
And she started reading. Something else that was so important was the he lived far out in the country. In
he
the
did.
Woods.
He lived up in northern Minnesota near the Boundary Waters Canoe yes, and yes. Area.
Yes. And her how she changed when mm-hmm. she went up there, when she left the city.
Mm-hmm.
And each time she left the city, she became more and more aware of the importance mm-hmm. of the natural world.
Yes.
And how important it was to her. I don't think she'd thought about it much before.
That's
until
right.
she began to experience it. But those beautiful scenes where she was swimming in the mm-hmm. in the lake on his property, and the silkiness of the water. It was so sensuous. There a lot of water in that. Well, of course, Boundary Waters. That's
right.
That's what it
I
is.
I was recently up in Minnesota, too, uh-huh. and I hadn't been up there for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
I lived there in my 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And I recently went back up, and I thought, okay, I hope I got this right. And I went with a friend, and we swam in a lake, and I thought, oh.
Yes, you got it right.
This is the kind of thing you just don't forget, that yes. sensory feeling of the lake.
That's right.
Georgia, I think in particular, she was not an intellectual thinker.
No.
She took in the world by feeling it, by sensing it, and by making friendships and mm-hmm. her relationship with her dog. I think that helped me as a writer mm-hmm. to feel and see those things as she would see them.
And I knew that at some point she was going to get on that motorcycle and have a road trip. And I was so happy when I got to that part of the book, because there she went. And it was a wonderful trip. She hadn't really traveled much over the country.
And no, not at all.
She went to the national parks, and it was just, it changed her.
It really did.
Yes.
So much of this is about Georgia finding herself opening up mm-hmm. and finding that there's so much more to the world and mm-hmm. to herself mm-hmm. than she ever imagined.
Mm-hmm. And learning to trust the world.
And learning to trust, being yes. prepared, but learning to trust.
That's right. That's right.
Who was it? I can't remember who said, having an open mind is wonderful just as long as it's not so open that your brain falls out. And I think that's what she was worried about. She was a little worried about being too open.
Yeah.
But she found ways to not be reckless,
right.
to be alert and prepared, and then mm-hmm. to be open.
Right. Did you ever see or hear of a movie called 1 Week? It's a Canadian film. And the plot is a young man gets a bad report from the doctor that he's has a terminal illness. And on the way home, he sees a motorcycle for sale, impulsively buys it, and sets off across Canada. And, it's a series of gorgeous photography.
I would have to see that movie.
You have to find this movie. It's called 1 Week.
Rosemary, I don't think I told you. Recently, I've taken a lot of or a trip that goes through a lot of the same country as Georgia went through, and I took a lot of photographs. So I have a new photo series on my website called What Georgia Saw.
Wonderful.
It's assemblinggeorgia.com.
Uh-huh.
Right. That'll take you there.
Right. Well, wonderful. I'll go home and look it up. Yeah. And since you do your own photography, it's a natural.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was very fulfilling to the reader to go on the road trip with Georgia. Mm, and it was like, this is what we've been leading up to.
Yeah.
And of course, the trip was so important to her development and her healing from early trauma in her life.
That's right.
Yeah. And she'd had a complicated life.
A lot of the characters have their own narratives.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
where they touch is what I found interesting.
Yes.
And it is, I guess, complex.
Yes.
Hopefully I wove it together well enough to have it be all of sort of one cloth. But,
yes.
But I don't know if any of us have very simple lives.
Yes. Yeah. To me, they were stars in their orbits that mm-hmm. you knew that at some point these orbits would coincide, but you weren't quite sure how the author was going to bring that about. But I thought you did that so skillfully.
And isn't that part of life?
Yes.
I mean, when we think of how we touch each other's lives,
right. mm-hmm. You just never know.
When mm-hmm. something happens to one person, it doesn't just happen to that one
mm-hmm.
person.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, I just have to ask you this. Mm-hmm. Do you ride a motorcycle?
I don't.
Have you always wanted to?
I've ridden on the back, and there was a period of time where I did want to ride on a motorcycle. I have a lot of courage about certain things,
mm-hmm.
but motorcycles and being on the road is not particularly one of them. I actually am a little more like Frank in that way.
Well, and Georgia, too. I mean, you
yeah.
brought out so well.
Well, so I let her be my alter ego.
Yeah. But her hesitancy at first.
Yes.
Can I do this? Do
mm-hmm.
I dare? It was a right. long time before she got on that motorcycle and rode away.
Well, she had built up her confidence in building the bike.
That's right.
So she did mm-hmm. have that already, but mm-hmm. I don't think she had owned it yet.
Mm-hmm.
She felt as though this bike wasn't really hers, and it was this precious thing.
Mm-hmm.
But she didn't have the confidence to say, all right, this is mine. I'm going to use this as part of my life. As a, well, Emery called it a tool for her to get on with her life.
People always ask me, what's a good read? And lately I've been telling them, well, there's this new book, and it's called Assembling Georgia, and it's about motorcycles. And people say, motorcycles? Well, you know, you've got to read it. It's just excellent. And so the book is Assembling Georgia. The author is Beth Karpel. And this is Rosemary Manchester, your host for A Novel Idea. And you've been listening to Beth and me talk about her writing, her work, her life about Assembling Georgia. And she tells me she's already at work on the next book, which is certainly good news.
Thank you so much.
It's been such a pleasure to have you in the studio.
It's been great being here.
I hope you enjoyed this show. We heard from three authors this evening. Stephanie Friel, whose book of very short stories is called Feeding Strays. We also heard from Chester Aaron, a book of fiction for young adults called Gideon, just republished by Zumaya Press. And then we heard from Beth Karpel with her first novel, Assembling Georgia. I want to thank the people who helped put the show together. And special thanks to Pat Nolan and KOWS-LP in Occidental, the West County's community radio station. Thanks to our engineer, Sean Knight, and to producer Suzanne Lang. And this is your host, Rosemary Manchester, reminding you that there's no such thing as too many books. ¶¶